you know, we...
Arise, ye prisoners of starvation! Arise, ye wretched of the earth! For justice thunders condemnation! A better world's in birth!
If you were born in the early 1980s through the mid-90s, you've entered adulthood during Obama, the financial crisis of 2008, DACA, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, and the political upheavals of Trump and Sanders. What might these experiences imply for the labor movement in the US? My name is Sanjeev Gupta, and this is Socialism in the Time of Corona. In this podcast, I'm talking with people with deep experience in socialist and progressive politics, especially in the US. Our overarching question is, during this pandemic, how might we not only defend whatever gains we've made to this point, but actually advance them? My guests this month include Doug Henwood, writer and host of the podcast Behind the News, Francis Boyes and Eric Blanc, organizers with the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, Mike Elk, editor of the Payday Report, and Ruth Milkman, labor sociologist at the City University of New York. As part of this month's focus on labor during the pandemic, I was curious about the role millennials have been playing in the labor movement. So I talked to Ruth Milkman, Research Director of the School of Labor and Urban Studies at the City University of New York and Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. Milkman has studied the impact on women workers in the U.S. of economic crisis and war in the 30s and 40s, in the 1930s and 40s, the impact on workers and unions of the restructuring of the U.S. automobile industry in the 1980s and 90s, and the labor practices of Japanese-owned factories in California. More recently, she has studied millennial generation activists and low-wage immigrant workers. Her new book, Immigrant Labor and the New Precariat, comes out this July. Episode notes, as usual, contain links to selected work. We know that there's a general resurgence of activism following Occupy. And so are you saying that labor activism is sort of part of that general trend among millennials? Or are you trying to point to something specific about millennials in the labor movement that we maybe haven't seen before?
I think both. So when I wrote that paper, the ASA paper, there really wasn't a lot happening along these lines in this generation. I mean, it was just beginning, but I didn't include that because it didn't seem very significant at the time.
Yeah.
I think it's really expanded since then. And so there is a new generation of labor activists, including quite a few DSAers.
Mm-hmm.
but, you know, not only that, it's just begun to. So some of them came out of Occupy Wall Street, and that's what radicalized them. And as that fell apart, people were looking for other arenas in which to work, and some of them turned to the labor movement. The other thing that's happened, though, is young people, especially college-educated young people, who also dominated in those other movements that I wrote about before, Occupy, Black Lives Matter, and all, it was overwhelmingly college-educated people. Mm. And similarly, inside the labor movement, we've seen a lot of recent organizing among journalists, especially online journalists, for example, who tend to be quite young and highly educated, and that's why they're hired for those jobs, but they are not happy with the paying working conditions that they find. And so they have unionized. And I mean, it's a big chunk of the industry. It's not a very big industry in terms of numbers. So that hasn't made a huge dent in the, you know, overall union membership figures in the country or anything. But still, that's one example.
Mm.
Another is on university and college campuses. So we've seen, and this goes back a little further, a ton of organizing among teaching assistants, research assistants, and especially adjunct faculty, who again, you know, are that same demographic of highly educated young people whose expectations have not been met by the labor market, to put it, which is a great under exaggeration. Yeah. So, and even more recently, in about a year ago, when that breakout of teacher strikes in the red states, that is, you know, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, places like that, the teachers were diverse in terms of age, but the leadership came again from young people. And we're seeing it now with the pandemic. Stephen Greenhouse recently wrote a little article showing that actually many of the young supporters of Bernie Sanders' campaign, when he dropped out of the race for the Democratic nomination, began turning their energies to organizing essential workers. And some of the protests that we've seen have been facilitated by that wave of activism. So it's become a major arena for that generation. And the activism itself, well, you asked me, like, why them?
Yeah.
So there's a whole bunch of things that I think have led to what I call in the ASA piece a new political generation. And those are not limited to labor activists, but more generally, this new generation of progressive activists who work in a bunch of different arenas, not just labor, but also, you know, struggles for racial justice, at one time Occupy Wall Street, gender justice struggles, so on. And I think, you know, we can point to a couple of different things that have produced that consciousness. That probably the single most important one, at least until this year, was the financial crash of 2008. Because this generation was just entering the labor market when that happened. And so, having done everything right, and again, I'm talking about college educated kids who, you know, went to school, did well enough to get into college, got good grades, all the rest of it, and then faced the post Great Recession labor market where opportunities were extremely limited. And there was a kind of acceleration of trends toward making jobs more precarious that had begun before the recession, but, like, you know, greatly accelerated then. So they were either unemployed or underemployed. And if they were employed, they often found themselves in extremely insecure jobs that were not, properly remunerated, what we call in the sociology land precarity was the name of the game. And so in response to that, you know, people saw that the system was not working for, and these were privileged people within that system, supposedly, right? Yeah. But in that generation, they weren't so privileged, and they were laden with student debt. And on top of that, finding very dim prospects in employment terms. And so all of that combined with the kind of expectations, which weren't just about, you know, having a decent job and way of life, but also, this generation came of age in the early 20th century when we supposedly lived in a post-racial society. Barack Obama was elected to the presidency. And yet they saw, as the Black Lives Matter movement brought to public awareness, enormous police brutality directed at people of color, all kinds of other racial injustice all around them. They were led to think this was that the problems of gender inequality had been largely overcome, and then woke up to the fact that sexual assault was rampant in both workplaces and college campuses and other places. And the huge growth of inequality more generally in the society as a whole was also very striking. So, you know, that collision between expectations of a better society and the realization that those were false promises, it can be very radicalizing and was for a big chunk of this generation. So again, it didn't move into the labor arena right away, but we saw that right after the financial crash, with the birth of things like Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, the campus movement about sexual assault, stuff like that. And now it's increasingly focused on labor justice. So, and not just on behalf of these workers themselves, though that's the most sort of tangible version of it, what I mentioned before, the adjunct and teacher and journalism and so on, that kind of organizing. But also they're now taking jobs on staff of unions and, you know, doing community-based organizing of various kinds among, well, right now, essential workers. But, you know, for a while that's been going on. And so, yeah. So there is kind of some kind of formation of a generational shift inside the labor movement, which is sorely needed because it's it needs some shaking up.
Well, say more about that. Like, when shaking up in terms of the overall sense of, you know, what unions or the labor movement can achieve, or how they're actually going about doing that, or both?
Both. And I think the biggest single problem is, you know, unions have been under attack now for quite a few decades. And basically, you know, the standard break point that people point to is the 1981 air controller strike. That's 40 years ago now, almost. Mm. And there were signs of those kind of attacks even before that. So the labor organizations that have been struggling along since that time have this quite justified sense that they're besieged, that they're, so they have developed this very defensive, paranoid almost mentality. And that is not always conducive to the most creative strategies and the most bold initiatives. So there is a kind of circling of the wagons in many unions and a sense that they're just hanging on for dear life and worrying about the members they already have, which they are right to be worried about. This is not, you know, this is all understandable, but it hasn't been that helpful in terms of rethinking conventional wisdom about organizing, figuring out, you know, what to do in these rapidly changing circumstances. And so young people tend to be better at that anyway. And I think an infusion of a new generation with a different agenda and a different set of priorities is a good thing. The other thing about union leadership is it tends to get older because insofar as union leaders are drawn from the rank and file, no one really wants to go back to the job that they came out of. You know, it's upward mobility to become a union leader. And so people tend to stick around until they die or retire. So, and in a movement that isn't growing, that means there isn't a lot of youth presence. But, you know, that's beginning to change. And I think that's good for everybody involved.
Well, gosh, I mean, you know, people sticking around till they die or retire happens in, you know, other contexts as well.
Oh, yes, including our industry, yes. For example, if that's what you're thinking of higher education. Yeah, sure. Although there, it's funny, like, you know, some people I know who are at, you know, at or past the conventional retirement age talk about that, and they say, well, if I retire, maybe that'll create a job for a young person. On the other hand, the restructuring that's going on in higher education means that they're more likely to be replaced by, you know, it might be a young person, but they'll be an adjunct, not in the same job at all. So it's not clear that you can really contribute anything that way. But I'm not really talking about the bodies or how old they are, but more the imagination and strategic repertoire. Absolutely. That's available, which I think is very different for this new generation, you know, who have been formed by a very different kind of history than their elders.
You know, so what you said about, which I haven't quite thought about it in this way, that there's been a general collision between what people coming of age over the last, you know, 10, 15 years in terms of a broad range of conceptions about what, let's say specifically the US should be like or already was like, and the discordance between what they've actually experienced and what they were told to experience has just, you know, created sort of this broad kind of basis for young people's involvement. You know, so and I see that certainly on campus. What I'm wondering is if we have particular historical precedents, maybe especially in the US, but also in other places, of younger people reinvigorating a labor movement, like at a particular historical moment, you know, so maybe during an economic crisis or you know, some other sort of kind of moment. So do we have examples of that where there's a particular, yeah?
Well, I should say one other thing. Yes, I think the answer is yes. But also keep in mind that social movements, this is different from the labor movement, which, as I tried to explain a minute ago, is like top heavy in terms of age, often because of the fact that people don't leave.
Yeah.
But social movements, grassroots movements, tend to be dominated by young people. I mean, activism is a young person's trade mostly. You know, there's all those old sayings about, you know, about that young people have the literature on social movements talks about biographical availability. Mm-hmm. And so it's often pointed out that young people, you know, often are not yet parents. They might be students. They don't have demanding jobs necessarily. They have the space in their lives to take on this kind of stuff. And if you put that together with the kind of radicalization that we talked about a minute ago, you know, that helps explain it. In the labor movement, in periods of growth, that has attracted young people in the past. And, you know, in the U.S., that means really you have to go back to the 1930s to find, you know, a large-scale example of that. But when the independent CIO was formed in 1935, and that was the beginning of a big upsurge in unionism, like your late colleague Dan Clawson has written about, the organizers often were quite young, in contrast to those who had been stalwarts of organized labor prior to that time. They weren't all young, but they were disproportionately so. So, you know, I don't think it's unusual, it's particular to this time. But what is different today is the focus on what that generation likes to call intersectionality, a term borrowed from academia, strangely enough, but this focus on not just class inequality, but also race, sexuality, gender, and so on, disability even. That's very different from, you know, earlier examples, at least in this country, and I think probably worldwide. I mean, it is a transnational phenomenon. My own research is really just on the U.S., so I can't really say much about the rest of the world, unfortunately, but maybe you can find another interviewee to cover that.
And, you know, even the U.S. by itself, we certainly need to learn about the past and the labor movement here. So, you know, I'm thinking back to the, I mean, there are these, among the more progressive and socialist and communist strains in the labor movement in the U.S., there were these self-conscious attempts to overcome racism and recruit especially African Americans and so on. But I do, the general understanding of the what you call, you and, you know, all of us call intersectionality as almost its own thing, I agree that that is sort of new and in keeping with the rest of the sensibilities of, you know, the times and people coming of age in these times. That really does seem to be a thing by itself.
I think so. And they use that word, you know, I have a kid who's 28 years old, and he, I remember when I first heard that word coming out of his mouth, and I was sort of shocked, like, where did you pick that up? You know, he wasn't somebody who studied in women's studies or anything like that.
Yeah.
And it's just a regular part of their vocabulary and consciousness. You know, it's just diffused throughout, at least the, you know, college educated component of that generation, which, by the way, is it's the most educated and most ethnically diverse generation in U.S. history. There's never been as much, you know, no previous generation had the same degree of education. So, yeah. And there's another thing we haven't talked about that's part of the story, too, and maybe not as important in the labor movement as some other arenas, although under, you know, the current conditions that we're facing right now with the pandemic, it could be quite important, which is that they are what some people call digital natives. These are people who grew up taking the internet and social media and all the rest of it for granted in a way that my generation, I guess I'm a boomer, you know, I had to learn it and I still haven't really caught up to them. So that is a great asset too. And we saw in movements like Occupy and Black Lives Matter that that set of skills could be deployed quite effectively to help mobilize folks. And I don't know, it's a very early days, but it seems like in the situation that we're in now where people can't organize in conventional ways by, you know, organizing big gatherings in the streets or whatever, that could be a great resource as well. And they're the ones who know how to do it. Yeah. In contrast, in the, you know, the old line labor movement, I'm constantly shocked by the fact that some of these unions still use fax machines, you know, and are far from adept at those kind of things. So that's another way in which this infusion of youth into the ranks of, you know, union staffers and leaders is a really much needed development.
Yeah, I mean, in watching especially my undergrad students, I've actually concluded that they have differently built thumbs than us, because I cannot physically do the things that they can. And, you know, yeah. There has to be some consequence of the technological development on, I mean, so that's entirely to be expected that, you know, people should be able to, like, they've grown up with these things and they should be better at it.
And not only that, but, you know, it's like language. You know, if you don't learn, if you try to learn a language when you're 40 years old, it's like a million times harder than if you do it when you're, well, 4 years old, especially, but yes. Even 10 years old or, you know, anytime before puberty. So Having grown up with all this technology as just sort of part of the general environment, you know, means that they have that aptitude that's harder to, you know, it's not impossible for older people to develop it, but it's much more difficult. And, you know, it's just, for them, it's just normal. It's just part of, you know, the world that they grew up in. So, yeah, I think that helps too. And we've already seen a lot of imaginative uses of that. Unfortunately, some older folks like our current president have also figured out yes. how to deploy things like Twitter yes. to their advantage politically. So it's not just young people anymore. But I still think they have an edge in that arena. And again, in the labor movement, it's been kind of, you know, a late development. So it's great to see that emerging finally in that sense.
So, Ruth, can I ask you about the other group that you've written recently about? And I know you can continue to be interested in immigrant sort of involvement in the labor movement, especially, and the potential yeah. there. You know, especially with respect to the pandemic, do you have some sense of what we might expect from, you know, migrant workers activism, and whether that sort of intersects at all with the younger sort of the issues we were just talking about?
Well, the only place it intersects with the youth thing is it's not really in the labor movement so much, but among dreamers, you know, that is another obviously young person's movement, because yeah. to be eligible for DACA, you had to be, you know, young. Yeah. And they also are disproportionately college educated. So there's an immigrant youth movement that's been very dynamic and still is around, although we're, you know, dreading this upcoming Supreme Court decision on whether DACA is going to survive, and who knows. But anyway, there it's really clear in terms of the generational thing. I don't think it's so much the case in the immigrant component of organized labor. And here, you know, since 2017, when Trump took power, things have changed quite a bit in that all these attacks on immigrants, and now that even the closing of borders and the things that the Trump administration has done since the pandemic took off, you know, have repressed a lot of the organizing that was happening before. But it's so ironic that, for example, in the meatpacking industry, which Trump tried to make a executive order to force plants to stay open, it's not really enforceable, it turns out. But without once mentioning that workforce is overwhelmingly foreign-born. And, you know, and a chunk of it is unionized, although the union is very weak in that industry these days for various reasons. Well, they're not all immigrants, but we know that black and brown workers are overwhelmingly overrepresented in the ranks of essential workers, and also in the ranks of those who are being killed by the pandemic. So it's, you know, I haven't seen any good numbers on how many of them are born in other countries, but clearly a big chunk. In terms of activism, though, it's more limited. You see it some in the meat processing and poultry processing plants, that those workers are overwhelmingly foreign-born, and some of them have become active in, you know, demanding productive equipment and stuff like that, and safe working conditions. And then there's whole industries that have a lot of immigrants in them, that with the history of union activism, that have basically, you know, become arenas of mass unemployment. I'm thinking of the hotel and restaurant industry, for example, which also employs tons of foreign-born workers. And as you know, they're all closed now, so there's not much opportunity for activism per se. Immigrants have been excluded from the limited benefits available under the various congressional stimuli acts that have been passed. They're excluded from a lot of the benefits, or lots of other workers, it turns out. There's a lot of holes in those provisions, but still. So I don't think we're going to see a big upsurge of activism from that group, except maybe the Dreamers. In the near term. But, you know, what I've written about in previous years prior to Trump is that there's a lot of reasons why that population of workers is much more receptive to organizing efforts by unions and other worker organizations than U.S.-born workers, partly because, you know, for low-wage immigrants, the main reason they come here in the first place is often to have a better life for themselves and their family. And so they're eager to advance economically. Not that U.S.-born workers aren't, but there's a kind of selection effect in terms of who shows up and has the gumption to undertake the very arduous process of crossing national borders and setting up a new life in a new country. So they tend to be very responsive when the opportunity to organize does come along. And we've seen that over and over again in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. It's much more complicated right now for given the aggressiveness of immigration enforcement and so on, particularly for those without authorization to be here. But there's so many ironies and contradictions in the situation too, though, because not just the meat processing and so on, but also in agriculture, the one exception that Trump grudgingly offered to his border closing was to permit growers to continue to recruit guest workers to work in the fields. And overwhelmingly, the people who pick the fruits and vegetables and process them too are foreign-born immigrants, many of them undocumented or guest workers. So, you know, that those are, if there's anything essential in the workforce, it's that, and they don't get any recognition for that, really.
Yeah. So, you know, the contrast between the what you describe as the basis for immigrants being especially, you know, wanting to organize perhaps in the recent past compared to now, where the repression is much more intense. And so, you know, so you might still want to organize, but there's much more at risk, or you're much more fragile.
But still, if there's, suppose the election goes, you know, if Trump is not elected in November and there's a new administration in Washington and some repair to the damage that Trump has done on the immigration policy front, you know, then I could imagine that movement reemerging big time, because there's just enormous desire for change and, you know, interest in making it happen. It's really not possible to realize right now.
Well, so that maybe is a nice way to sort of bookend this, where, you know, one of the things I think a lot of folks like us are kind of wondering is, A, is it basically at this point, you know, anyone but Trump, or at least anyone, you know, in the Democratic Party but Trump, versus, you know, so with the, you know, since Obama also deported so many people that, you know, is it more than that? Like, what's your take on this?
Well, yeah, it's a depressing fact about Obama, but still, compared to what's happened since he was, since Trump came in, it's very different. I mean, the deportations, which I was very strongly and am opposed to, were meant to. The idea was that if he had credibility as a leader who was enforcing immigration law at the border, then that would make it possible to generate the political momentum necessary to win immigration reform and a path to legalization for the undocumented and so on. With Trump, there was no pretense of that. Deportations were simply, you know, and it's really more Stephen Miller than Trump that organized all this, but were just part of a much broader agenda of purging immigrants from the United States and demonizing them in every possible way and building political power among U.S.-born workers and others on that basis through the, you know, what many people call the immigrant threat narrative, this idea that immigrants are a threat to the well-being of U.S. workers, when in fact, of course, we know that the opposite is true, both historically and now. So it's, you know, there's no comparison, but yeah, I agree with you that it does make a difference who's in the White House, and we'll see. I also think in the Obama years, some people say that, well, there was a social movement then for immigration reform. But in 2021, if there is a new administration, especially if Biden is the president, there is going to, you know, who, of course, was Obama's vice president. it's not going to happen on a significant scale without a lot of pressure from below. So that's a challenge to progressives everywhere to think about, you know, both how to frame the immigration issue in a new way for a new administration, and especially in the context of what's likely to be an ongoing pandemic problem, and generating enough political pressure on that administration to act. I don't think we'd see any, even with Biden, I can't imagine anything like what Trump's been doing, but it's not his top priority by any, yeah, by any stretch of the imagination. And it would have to, you know, for that to change would require a lot of mobilization. But going back to the original topic here, I think that young people do care about this issue and are committed to, both in the labor movement arena and others, you know, trying to promote the rights of immigrants and to both to better jobs and other kinds of rights like to healthcare. So that's what will be required. And I think this young generation we've been discussing, you know, yeah, are key to that. They're the ones who are the most likely to mobilize along those lines, along with, you know, there are all kinds of other things that we need, of course, but that's a big one. And it's a, yeah, it's much needed. And the labor movement could be quite instrumental in that. You know, under Obama, it didn't work out, obviously, but the efforts to win immigration reform, labor was a big player in that. And this is actually even before Obama, under Bush, too. The unions played a big role in that movement. For example, in those, this seems like a long time ago now, but in when there were those giant immigrant rights marches in 2006, unions were very much part of that whole alliance. So
yeah,
you can imagine that all being reborn again, though the pandemic makes it more challenging in some ways.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, one can imagine everything from it being reborn to taking a nasty turn with, you know, some sense of competition among, I mean, the heightened competition among native-born and, you know, migrant sort of workers, to everything in between. And
yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I think then it's our job as progressives to frame the issues properly. I mean, my own view is that the right response to xenophobic narratives is to point out the reality, which is that, and I've written about this too, as you know, the sequence of events that's led to low-wage immigrant employment is that employers took steps to degrade and deunionize what were once well-paid, good jobs. This is for non-college educated workers. And U.S.-born workers mostly abandoned those jobs because they were no longer attractive, and that's when employers hired immigrants. And so U.S.-born workers have every reason to be enraged at the situation that's emerged, but they should be directing that rage at employers, not at immigrants, who are as much the victims as the beneficiaries of that. So, you know, that's how I look at it. But it would be some work to make that understood by the wider public and by U.S.-born workers themselves, who, as you say, might otherwise feel that these are their competitors, not their allies.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. That is the work to do. And it was the work to do, you know, years ago, and it's still the work to do now, and maybe even more critical now, especially, you know, I'm thinking of the states where Trump swung those, you know, few counties that might have turned the election. You know, that's another set of conversations about what, you know, what works and what doesn't work in sort of trying to reach those people.
And undoing the damage, because the Trump narrative has taken hold in a lot of those communities. And, you know, but I remember in 2016, and at the time I found it very puzzling, I think I get it now, that in those communities, there were workers who would tell pollsters that they were for Trump, but if that didn't work out, they were for Bernie. And vice versa. Some of them supported Bernie, and they said, well, if he doesn't get the nomination, I'm for Trump. And at the time, that seemed crazy to me, like how those, they seemed like opposite ends of the political spectrum. And of course, they are in many respects. But they're, the differences between right-wing and left-wing populism, and the latter, the left-wing populism, does not scapegoat anybody in the way that Trump and his colleagues do. That's the difference. So, but in both cases, there's a critique of the status quo and of elites that have done so much to damage the possibilities for prosperity for working people. So, you know, I think there is potential to turn that around just in the way there was then. But it's a challenge, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't buy that, you know, the Bernie and Trump sort of choice, you know, one response to that is that all of these folks were basically against, you know, Clinton. Hillary Clinton, that is.
Well, they were. That's true, too.
Yeah. And now
but,
how much
but
of
they
that?
Also, yeah, sorry. That was very important. Absolutely. But I think also people resonated to Bernie's critique of capitalism and of the things that had done so much to destroy opportunities for working class people. You know, he's one of the few candidates ever in my lifetime who's talked about the working class in that way. And that resonated also. And Trump did it too. He just didn't deliver on any of that, except in the demonizing immigrants department. But you know, lives have not gotten better for those workers despite all his promises. So, and you know, we'll never know if that would have been the case if we had a Sanders administration. But it was a very different approach to criticizing the way things are, and one that didn't just scapegoat another group, but pointed to where the problem really is, which is among elites who've created policies that have generated, you know, unprecedented levels of income inequality and taken away the social safety net and destroyed unions and made good jobs into bad jobs and all the rest of it. The immigrants had nothing to do with any of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's, you know, that's a great, I mean, it's a forbidding list of things that one would have to roll back, like you said.
Absolutely.
You know, never mind moving forward. But you know, it's happened before, and it's the way of, you know, big change. I mean, there's a certain amount of undoing, and that's what we need to focus on. And in some ways, regardless of the outcome of the next election, you know, like you're saying, if it's not Trump, we still need to do the work of you know, keeping pushing. And of course, if it is Trump, then in some ways even more so. I mean,
I think so. And I do think the pandemic crisis is an opportunity. I mean, it could go in a lot of different directions, obviously, but it certainly has opened people's eyes all around the country to some of the problems that progressives have been talking about for a long time and falling on deaf ears prior to that. So
yeah.
I think there's nobody in the country who doesn't appreciate now the importance of things like paid sick leave and even Medicare for all, as we see the chaos that's, you know, developed in the last couple months. And I think also the contributions of low-wage workers to everyday survival and everyday life for the rest of us are also highlighted. So, you know, that is an opportunity, but it will be a lot of work. It's a big challenge to sort of make that into some kind of permanent lasting change and make sure things don't go back to how they were, which would be really tragic.
Are socialists and the left generally up to this challenge? If we are, it will be due in no small part due to the energy and savvy of millennials. They've played a defining role in creating an infrastructure of openly leftist politics, organizations, media, electoral candidates, and office holders that has not existed in the US for more than half a century. Which means that the generation coming of age now, during the pandemic and the current economic crisis, has resources available to it not available to the millennials themselves. Over the next few weeks, this podcast will take a closer look at labor issues here in Western Massachusetts. I'll be talking to Rose Bookbinder of the Pioneer Valley Workers' Center and Claire Hammonds of the UMass Labor Center. We'll then zoom out back to the national level with Jake Rosenfeld, author of What Unions No Longer Do, a study of the larger social consequences of union decline in the US. Later in June and July, the podcast will branch out into other pandemic-related questions, housing, welfare, and, of course, elections. Join us in thinking aloud about how our day-to-day work during Corona can cohere into a battle plan for democratic socialism after the pandemic.